Well, thanks very much for giving us some time to join us today. Thanks, especially if this is your first time at the London Bridge Talks, as I know it is for a few. Particular welcome to you. It's great to have you with us. Now, I realise also that coming straight to this ancient book, written sort of sometime around 500 BC, so about 2,500 years out of date, I realise coming from the business that you've had this morning, is quite a sort of step change, isn't it? So let me just bring you up to speed with where we've been. We've been in this book for the last 3 weeks. So let me give you a quick overview of what's going on. God's people have gathered back in Jerusalem. They've been in exile for some time. They've been back in Jerusalem for a little bit now, and they're rebuilding the temple. They're working under the edict of the then Persian king, Darius. And Darius had actually even given them money to go back and rebuild the temple, which was an amazing thing in God's provision. And God's people have been back in Jerusalem building the temple. There's about 40,000 of them gathered in Jerusalem, working away. We've had three talks so far in the book of Haggai. The first chapter, we saw the priority. Make building the temple a priority. Get building was basically the message. Second chapter, keep building. They kept at it for a few weeks. They felt a little bit discouraged because they began to compare the building project they were involved in with the good old days of Solomon's temple, and they thought, oh, this looks a little bit pathetic. And the message through the prophet Haggai via God was, don't be discouraged. The future temple will be even more amazing than the old temple. Keep going, keep going. So start building, keep building. And then thirdly, last week, we saw building God's strength. There was a tendency to start sort of being engaged in temple building activity in their own strength. And the correction last week was, keep building in God's strength. Rely on grace, not on activity. So what does all that mean for us? Well, let me just remind you again, we've gone here each week over the last few weeks of what building a temple looks like today. Again, a corporate activity. If you're a Christian, something you're involved with today, building God's temple. Just flip to 1 Peter. Keep a finger in Haggai. Flip forward to 1 Peter. I didn't actually write a page number down. Somebody who gets there can shout it out. 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, page 1015. You can sort of begin to think as you read a book like Haggai, what on earth is building a physical temple got to do with me? Well, wonderfully, the New Testament picks up this imagery of building a temple today, not physical, but spiritual. Listen to 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 4. As you come to him, that is Jesus, a living stone, rejected by men, but in the sight of God, chosen and precious, you yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. It's a wonderful image, and I don't think it's that hard to understand. We Christians are being compared to living bricks, being built into a temple, a superstructure. And as we come to today's passage, that superstructure is the structure we need to keep our eyes on. We need to build, because the message today, the headline, if you like, sort of strap lines as we close off this little mini book in the Old Testament, build because time is running out. Build because time is running out. And the principle for us to sort of take back to the offices and think about is that certainty about the future should radically shape the present. And I guess that's something we're familiar with, isn't it, on a sort of small scale illustration. I mean, think about preparing for an exam. You may not like to be reminded about your exam preparation days, but the date in the diary sort of approaches, doesn't it? It seems to sort of seem ages away, and then suddenly it's upon you. And I can either sort of stick my head in the sand and live in denial, oh, it'll be fine, I'll sort of get through it, or I can use the time well, diligently, as the day approaches, chipping away at what I know needs to be done to prepare for that final exam. Well, in a little bit of a similar way, as we come to this bit of Haggai, Haggai is being, through God, obviously, he's the spokesman for God, his prophet, and he's giving clarity to this future day. He's explaining to the people what will happen in the end. It's always lovely to be told what's going to happen in the end, isn't it? Unless, of course, you're reading a novel when you don't want to know what's going to happen in the end, because it rather spoils it. Although even then, I mean, we do like going back to old films and seeing them again, don't we? I mean, there's something about the, we have a bit of a tradition in our family around Christmas. You know, we love to choose a family we've all seen before. We know the end and we love sort of seeing the story. Well, that's what we're getting given here. We're getting a glimpse into the end. This is the end. What a privilege. We're not left guessing as God's people today. Here is what is going to happen. Clock ticking. The end is coming. There's going to be destruction. Now, I think if I was writing this book, I mean, Haggai's receiving the oracles from God, so it's not like he has a lot of choice. But, you know, my first reaction would be, theoretically, if I was writing Haggai, I think I'd want to sort of end my very small claim to fame, the book of Haggai, with something more inspiring than the destruction of this world, which is basically what happens here. I think I'd want to give a glorious vision of this final building project and how it stands and how it sort of lasts for eternity, which is true. And we've sort of already seen that. Haggai has made that point. I think I'd want to reinforce that and say, look, let me give you this really positive image. But as Haggai ends, he gives a different picture. He focuses instead on the surrounding kingdoms and nations and says, it's just a matter of time. Everything else will lie in ruin. And so rather than a really positive picture of the building project they are involved in, it's etch this into your minds. Everything else is going to end up in complete annihilation. It's a picture of carnage. And the tone throughout, as Tom was reading just there, I mean, in between all those complicated names, the tone throughout is apocalyptic. It is sobering. And I think it is meant to jolt us to our senses. That brings us to the first point. I'm going to read it again just so you can absorb the apocalyptic language. It's very short, isn't it? You'll see the first point there on the handout. All kingdoms of this world will face ruin. Have a look at verse 20. The word of the Lord came a second time to Haggai on the 24th day of the month. Speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I am about to shake the heavens and the earth and to overthrow the throne of kingdoms. I am about to destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the nations and overthrow the chariots and their riders, and the horses and their riders shall go down, every one by the sword of his brother. It's pretty doom and gloom, isn't it? Notice how it is all-encompassing. Verse 21, heavens and earth. There's no sort of wriggle room there. Everything is included. Verse 22, the throne of kingdoms, the strength of kingdoms. Here is God targeting the most sort of strong-held points of earth. It will all be laid to ruin. Four words are used to really sort of help us absorb all of that. We get verse 21, shake. 22, overthrow. Verse 22, destroy and overthrow again. God does not leave the people in the dark about the future. This is like the incoming tide on a city full of sandcastles. Everything will be laid flat in the end. And I think the really important point that comes out of the text is that this will happen soon. It is imminent. It is about to happen. Verse 21, I am about to shake the heavens and the earth. Middle of verse 22, I am about to destroy the strength of the kingdoms. It could happen at any moment. It's the next thing that will happen. If you were part of sort of God's people back then and you had a diary that you were trying to sort of make a note of, oh yeah, good point, Haggai, thanks. I'll just write that down. You might write down something like, you know, in your diary entry, total ruin of the world. And your diary will ask you, electronic, of course, will that event repeat? And you think, well, I know it's soon, it's imminent, so if it doesn't happen today, well, it may happen tomorrow. Yes, repeats every day until it happens, because that's the reality. The Lord says, I'm about to. It could be very soon. I think this comes as quite a challenge, doesn't it, as we sort of think about our day-to-day activity and the morning's business that we've had. I mean, first, we need to see the reality of the coming destruction. So there's the first point. The kingdoms of this world face ruin. Here's the second point. The king will be established. God's king will be established. Look at verse 23. On that day, here's the slightly more positive note, okay, after the sort of destruction, everything, sort of smoke coming up from all the kingdoms around. But on that day, verse 23, declares the Lord of hosts, I will take you, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, declares the Lord, and make you like a signet ring, for I have chosen you, declares the Lord of hosts. Sometime sometime in the future, on that day, the same day that the world will be destroyed, on that day, the Lord will make Zerubbabel like a signet ring. Now, the signet would have been something, of course, worn on the finger of the governor or the king. Sometimes it was an amulet that would have been worn around the neck. It was a mark of both authority and identity of the one who gives it. So to be like the signet means he will be the official and legal representative of the Lord, bearing his identity, bearing his authority. And so we mustn't miss the significance of this. This is massively significant because remember, Zerubbabel was just a governor. He's not described here as the king. Essentially, that means if he's a governor, he's basically a puppet of the superpower of the day, the Persian Darius. He's the one that has all the attention so far, doesn't he? Through the book of Haggai, 1 verse 1, Darius the king. 1 verse 15, Darius the king. 2 verse 10, in the second year of Darius. All references were to the Persian king Darius. That's quite a strange way for the Hebrews to write a book. But that's because their king, well, they didn't really have one at this stage. They just had this puppet governor, Zerubbabel. He was the best they had. So what words? I mean, look at those words again. Verse 23, on that day I will take you, O Zerubbabel, my servant, son of Shealtiel, and make you like a signet ring, for I have chosen you. You will bear my authority. You will bear my mark. My authority, my mark. Persian king, relatively insignificant compared to who you will be, the sort of person I'm going to make into you. We live down in Borough, not far away from here, stone's throw, or a couple of stones probably, the way I throw. We've got a little convenience store. We've been living in the same house now for about 17 years. And there's a little convenience store just around the corner next to the local pub, which we used to buy all of our cereal and milk and jam and all of that sort of thing, until Sainsbury's came and set up shop literally next door. It was one of those sort of mini Sainsbury's, which quite frankly is totally brilliant because it gives you everything at a much cheaper price, higher quality, less price. Sorry, I'm a big fan of Sainsbury's. It's all great. But I went back, I felt a bit sorry for the little convenience store, which is still going amazingly. I mean, they sell ridiculously overpriced sort of eggs and special brew lager and that sort of thing, but it's all there. And I went back in and asked them, so what's it like? What's it like existing next to Sainsbury's? And he looked at me quite serious. Well, we have a few loyal customers, he was saying. It's almost like he's saying, you're going to be one? I'm afraid I haven't been, but paid for some milk and a newspaper and went on. And I wondered how it sort of felt to exist in the shadow of this superpower. I mean, you're insignificant, you're nothing if you're a local convenience store next to Sainsbury's where everyone goes. It's really hard, isn't it? So, Darius, he controlled the chain of supermarkets, if the illustration is not obvious. While Zerubbabel, well, he was the landlord of the little convenience store. He was nothing, absolutely insignificant, so discouraging. Zerubbabel needed to know he was on the winning side. And these were the words. One day, his relatively insignificant project would be the only reality that stood. One day he would be like the signet ring, the superpower, the only superpower, because remember what's going to happen to every other power in the world. We can still see the smoke going up. Zerubbabel, the only reality. Well, we come to a problem. We come to a problem as we consider Jewish history at this stage, because as we fast forward from the book of Haggai, well, he never became the king. In fact, Darius remained in power unchallenged and reigned for a further 35 years. It looks absolutely like the word of God has failed as you go forward from the end of the book of Haggai. What happened in sort of wider history? Well, the Persian Empire itself remained in power until Alexander the Great. So they had quite a good innings. Alexander the Great came along in 336 BC. And then the people of God just exchanged one sort of tyrant leader for another. Something happened again when the Romans came in. The Romans came in and, Alexander was out. And the Romans were the sort of the superpower of the world for some time. And again, God's people were sort of living in relative oppression, hoping for the day when one day, the the Romans, or I suppose before that, Alexander and all his people, and before that, Darius and all his people, before that, the Babylonians. I mean, there's always been a superpower that's been in charge of God's people. God's people have always been oppressed, relatively speaking. Raises the question, though, doesn't it? Did Haggai get it wrong? Well, he didn't get it wrong. He was simply looking ahead, as so often the prophets do, looking ahead beyond the times that we see. You see, Zerubbabel received a promise. And while it wasn't fulfilled in him, it was fulfilled in the type of person that he is. He was, of course, in the line of the kings all the way from the king, from King David. And when he died, the promises that had been focused on King David and then through his sons to Zerubbabel one day, well, son of Shealtiel, were then passed on to his son and to his son and to his son. And isn't it interesting, as you turn over to Matthew's gospel, sorry, you better just do that. Again, I didn't write down a page number. Somebody who gets to Matthew's gospel, chapter 1, if you could just read it out, read out the page number. 807, Matthew chapter 1. Have a look. Isn't it interesting? These obscure names of the Old Testament, they're actually picked up in the genealogy in Matthew's gospel. So look down to verse 12, Matthew chapter 1. After the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Zerubbabel, the father of Abiud, Abiud the father of Eliakim, da-da-da-da-da-da. Keep on going down to verse 16. Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is the Christ. Isn't that interesting down the line? Sharon's smiling. It's great, isn't it? Suddenly the fulfillment all sort of comes into place. These random characters in the Old Testament were in the line of King Jesus. He, of course, is God's king and the final king. And his resurrection from the dead proves that he is the eternal king, and that his kingdom can never end, because if death can't stop somebody, nothing can stop someone. Again, though, we have a little bit of a problem as we sort of begin to draw threads here. We have a bit of a problem because Jesus isn't reigning at the moment, or at least it doesn't really look like it, does it? Not if you look at the front pages of the newspapers. Which means, like Zerubbabel, and like the people in Haggai's day, we are waiting for the promises to be fulfilled. But of course, we have a major advantage, because we know what God's final king is like. You see, Zerubbabel was just told, well, you're like a signet ring. Whereas we, 2,500 years later, we know what God's eternal king is like. And we've seen his quality, his character. The four Gospels give complete testimony to his life. So, where does that leave us? Well, we need to draw threads, don't we? In summary, two main points. The kingdoms of this world face ruin, and God's king will be established. Those are the facts. It is imminent. It's about to happen. And so let's try to draw threads together, a few lines of application as we close off this little book. I mean, what a great privilege it is to have God's clear diary laid out for us. This is the next thing that is going to happen in God's diary, and we've just been told exactly what that is. We're not left guessing, thinking, oh, one day God is going to do something, we don't know what it is. Here it is. One day he's going to set his king for all to see, to reign forever, and everything else will lie in ruin. And so we must ask, we absolutely must ask, have you taken refuge in this king? There is no other hope, and there is no other priority in life that has any weight or makes any ultimate sense. Have you taken refuge? If that's something that you're sort of thinking, I'm not quite sure what he means by that, why don't you have a chat to the person who brought you along today, the person who invited you, and say, what does it actually mean to be with King Jesus? The person who brought you along as a Christian will be able to explain what that means. There's another line of application, though. You'll see on the handout there as well. You know, what do we do? I mean, for those of us who've taken refuge, what do we do while we wait? He hasn't come yet. Doesn't look like he's coming during this meeting, although he could. And that's the right attitude to have. What do we do while we wait? Well, you'll see the second line there. Build the Lord's house. Build the Lord's house. You see, this final oracle gives a sharp focus to this work. We need to build the Lord's house with our eyes on the end, with our eyes on the next thing that God is doing. We need to build today. That means explaining the gospel to people, to other Christians, to build and strengthen, to people that don't know, because refuge in King Jesus is the only thing that counts. We need to build the house with our eyes on the end because of what is coming. Think of your colleagues. Think of the people you're about to go and rub shoulders with. A time ticking down, a clock, a counter. I used to go to a church. I've changed churches over the last sort of 5 or 6 years and minister of a different place now. And the church I used to go to, there was a gravestone. And on the gravestone, a very vivid depiction, an hourglass. And all the sand had run out. Time is running out. Right now, we live on borrowed time. The sand is ticking through the hourglass. And we need to be aware of that. And that should focus our time and our efforts. And you'll see there the last application. We need to build the Lord's house and beware of competing building projects, because it's so easy, isn't it, to get distracted with the other things that are going on around us. This has been the message through the book of Haggai. So easily, I mean, at the beginning they started sort of looking at their own houses and thinking, oh, I better get my own house in order and then I'll do the Lord's house. And then they got discouraged with their work and they started just giving up. And it's so easy, isn't it? There'll always be something else to give our attention to, and how true that is for Christians today. How much are you distracted even now, thinking about the client you've got to look after, thinking about the business meetings, just thinking about getting through to the weekend? These are massive distractions, and they end up actually pulling our attention away from what counts for eternity. One day, the only reality will be very different. One day, only one thing will last: the people that are built into this eternal building project. Living stones are all that stands in the end. And so as you work hard, well, it's worth just sort of thinking, where is my attention? Where is my focus? What is my priority? Have I got this final day when God's King is established for eternity? Have I got that in my sight? There's a few things to sort of think about as we close off the book of Haggai. What a great little book this is. God's building project, the only final reality.